Okay, so I will take up Bitzalel's challenge, which is try to say something new about the Megillah. The problem here is I don't know what we've talked about in the past here. I mean, I've taught the Megillah many times, and I don't know what I have taught here, especially since I learned the whole Megillah with Uri last year. So, you know, I've said many things about the Megillah in these walls, but how much of it was in the shiur and how much of it was when you guys were, how much it was 3 years ago before any of you were here besides for, you know, Chaim and Yuri and whatever and Shua. So I honestly don't know, but we'll talk about the Megillah until, you know, for a little bit and then fine. Okay. So, but we'll highlight different themes in the Megillah, and we'll see. I don't have a particular plan of which ideas I want to cover, but the benefit of the Megillah is a book we all know very well. And Bitzalel is like, that's why I know everything about this book.
I didn't say I know everything. I just don't hear anybody saying something new about it.
Okay, fine. So let me start, since I just mentioned this to Yosef, let me give, what? Oh, for sure. Yes, right. Furman has this nice thing about stories that everyone knows, that the problem with them is it's you get caught in what he calls the lullaby effect, right? It's the story we know too well, so that we read it and we don't realize how weird it is. His book is very good, but as I mentioned to Yosef, I happen to think that Ray Foreman's best work on the Megillah, for some reason, didn't make it into that book. It's a different audio series he gave a long time ago, but since you have both... Ray Foreman's work is excellent. His work on the Megillah is excellent, but I really don't know why this didn't make it into the book, because I find it to be even more fascinating than the stuff he does cover in it. So maybe I'll start with that, okay? So he has a whole series on the Megillah, where he highlights the extent to which the weirdness of the Megillah can be boiled down to its treatment of a single word, a word that appears almost nowhere else in Tanakh. Which word?
The word relating to the, forgetting.
No, not that one. That's what I said. It's not there, right? I know what's in that book. It's not this, right? In that one, he covers his Goats and Coats series material, right? Yeah, most of the Goats and Coats material and the fixing of the relationships of, you know, Ben Yosef and the resonances of Goats and Coats. Oh, well, maybe one day he'll do it. But there's one book that is not Hebrew that appears... Actually, you know, before I get to that, I do want to tell you, here's something that you definitely have never heard of. Bitzal, you probably... If you've heard of this, I'd be very impressed, right? Karabkin posted it last night. He posted it 3 years ago, and I was still in Toronto, and he posted it last night. But I'll start with this. It's a short idea, but if you've heard it, I'll be very impressed with your bakiyas.
Okay.
Rav Sadjagon asks, why does God's name never appear in the Megillah?
Okay.
What is Rav Sadjagon's answer, Bitzal, since you know everything about the Megillah?
Again, I know the ideas that everyone says.
Good. What's this idea? Why is God's name not there according to Rav Sadjagon? According to Rav Sadjagon,
I don't know.
Rav Sadjagon argues that the Megillah was originally a book.
Oh, it was a text book, you know.
It was originally a book that came from the Persian royal files.
Yeah.
And was then canonized, and Chazal were worried that if they put God's name in it, what would happen?
No.
That Persia would replace every time it said God with their God. But by removing any mention of divinity, they couldn't mess up which divinity we were talking about. See, you didn't hear it. There. Good. I got something you did. No, for sure, but the Sadjagon adds this, and he says, and that's why God's name is it. Now, the truth is that we do that in reverse to Persia, right? We mess with Persia that way. In a very celebrated passage in the beginning of a book that maybe some of you have read. In what book do we take a Persian text which mentions another god and replace their god with our god? Look at this. I'm going to get two things in you don't know. Amazing. Right? What book do we do this in? Not Daniel. Close, but not no cigar. Not Eo. Ezra. The book of Ezra opens up with Hatzarat Koresh, with Cyrus's declaration. And it says, Cyrus the Great says, why did he let the Jews go back to Eretz Yisrael to build the Beit HaMikdash? Because who told him? God. God, Yud, and a Hey, and a Vav, and a Hey. Elamai. It's true. Cyrus actually did think that the reason he told the Jews to go back to Jerusalem was because God had told him. In fact, we even have the document that says this from Cyrus, from the time of Cyrus, except it doesn't say God in it. Everything that it says in Tanakh, it says there, except it says that I was commanded by Marduk. Marduk, the God, the Persian God of the heavens, yes, chief God, to let people return to their countries and rebuild their temples, and that's why I did it. That's what it says in Hatzarat Koresh. Basically identical to what it says in Ezra, except we do the opposite. He thought it, that he, it was Marduk who inspired him, and we say, no, it was God who inspired him.
Okay. That, I've never heard that, but it's not a
firm
idea.
Oh, well, Oh, good. How is it related to a Purim idea? Yosef knows why it's related to a Purim idea?
I was just going to say because of
Ozadia. Well, that, no. There's a better reason why it's connected.
No,
because Mordechai is an assimilated name, which probably comes from Marduk.
Oh, my. I mean, I was going to bring up the whole question.
Just like Esther comes from Ishtar. No, Ishtar is the goddess of what?
The goddess of beauty.
Yeah, the goddess of is like Venus. Yeah, yes, because that is their assimilated names. You know their actual names, Hadassah, right? As it tells you, but their names, it has been claimed, maybe very assimilated names. It would be like calling a Jew Chris, except there it was Marduk, Mordechai, and Ishtar, which is Esther, right? Yeah, that. What? I have no, I mean, Chazal, I have speculations.
Rabbi, can I call myself and we'll have it?
No. I, it's not a good idea. Anyways. Fine. So, good. So now we've told you a few things you didn't know about the Megillah. But Ray Foreman's favorite, my favorite series of Ray Foreman highlights a different point. Is there is a word that in modern Hebrew you might not even realize is not originally Hebrew, but is originally, right, found in the Megillah, but right now it is a very common word in modern Hebrew, and that is dot. No, not das, not dalid ayin tuf, but dalid tuf, right? What does dot mean? Dot. What is, in modern Hebrew, what does dati mean? Religious, right? Dati, right? That word comes from the Megillah, dot. What's dot? Yeah, so it comes up sometimes in the Torah, very rarely. That's one time when it comes. It's Ish Das Lamo. Yes, it does come up there, right? But it's a very rare word. I didn't say it never comes up. It's a rare word in the rest of Tanakh. On the other hand, it comes up many, 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 many times. In the Megillah, in fact, it is a Leitwort, right? Leitwort is German for... In Hebrew, it's a milah mancha, right? A guide, or in English, a guide word. Right? It's a word that comes up that points to a theme by coming up over and over. Yes? Fine. So, dot. Dot comes up a lot. Tell me, give me some examples of where dot comes up.
In Esther?
In Esther, yes. Yes, it comes up elsewhere in Tanakh, very rarely, once in Chumash, yes. Eish dot lamo.
Oh. I just happened to turn around the page. Did he not say that? Say it. Maybe not.
Good. So it comes up. Let's talk about how many times it comes up. It comes up. Yes, the first time it comes in pasuk chet is hashtia kadat ein ones. The drinking was by the rule. What was the rule? That no one was forced. The law was that everyone did whatever they wanted. That's the law. That's the first time it comes up. Very good. Then it comes up just a few psukim later. In Pasuk Tedvav. I could be missing some, but I think next time is Pasuk Tedvav. Kedadma. Oh, you're right. I already missed one. That's how often it comes up. Vayomer melech hachamim yodei itim gichin v'armelech v'nei kol dat yodei dat vadin. This was the law, right? He consulted with his officers what to do with Vashti. In Pasuk Tedvav, kidat malasot bimalka Vashti. Al asher lo astad ma'amar ha-melech ha-shverosh bi'ad astari sim. Right, what is the law of what we should do? And then you get it several times in Haman's critique of the Jews. In Yotzet where? In Perek Aleph?
Yes,
you get it again. Thank you. Right? That it should be written with the law of Parasumadai that since Vashti didn't come to the king, so she should be gotten rid of and someone else be given. And then Haman talks about Dot. What does he say? There is a nation who Datehem Shonot. They have their own laws, right? And that's why, and over you get this obsession with dot, right? But here's the problem. There's a very big problem. If I ask you, what is the role, the purpose, the definition of law? What does law do? What is law supposed to do? What do laws do? Norms, laws, restrictions, principles.
They keep order.
Good. How do they keep order? What do they do?
Preventable from doing things that are
very good. They prevent people from doing crazy things, from doing the wrong things. They prevent people who might act on a whim from acting in anger, acting frivolously, because there are consequences, right? The role of law is to constrain human passion, right? To constrain frivolity, to maintain order. Great. What is the role of law in the Megillah? We've identified it as a light for it. What is its role?
No,
it's worse than that. Come on. Halavai should be ignored. Law is obsessive. Law is obsessive. Okay, let me just highlight something to you. Law in Persia, they are obsessed with law. It's not ignored. The exact opposite. How do I know it's not ignored? How do I know that law is an obsession in Persia? Obsession.
Because Ahasuerus couldn't do redaction.
Very good. Because at the end of the book, you find out that law is such an obsession that Ahasuerus said, once it's law, even the king himself cannot overturn it. Right? He can't do it. So Esther has to come up with the only other plan she has, which is to set a contradictory law. That you can do. You can have a contradictory law. You have two opposite laws on the books. That you can do. But to rescind a law, you can't do that. You can set an opposite law, right? You can say that on this day the Jews will be killed, and on that day the laws of the Jews shall defend themselves, right? You can do that. But you cannot override law. Nobody can. And we know that in at least according to Tanakh, this is not only true in the time of Ahasuerus. It's true in other cases in Persia. Thank you. Right. In the preceding government, it's true also. Because when Daniel is beloved by the king, he doesn't want to throw him into the lion's den, but he has no choice because he was tricked into sentencing him to death by lions, right?
And
it's not only that. It's not only that that we know. This is not the next point is not from Rabbi Foreman, but we know that law is obsessive in Persia, and historically we know this true as well. Why is law so important in Persia? There's a reason why law is so important in Persia. Thank you. Very good. Because it's big. Because it's really big. Because it's the first mega empire. It's the first mega empire. And in empires, it's in a small Little Kingdom, the king's word can be law. But you don't need, like, formalized law in the same way, because the king can, or at least the officers that he trusts, can be on top of things. In Persia, that's not the case. As Esther tells you, it's 127 provinces. If you want people to be loyal to you, you have to have a way of making sure they're loyal without the king being able to be involved. How do you do that? A strong legal system. And therefore, there's something else that becomes very important, which is closely related to this in Esther that we don't see anywhere else in earlier parts of Tanakh, is that who are the most important officers of the king? Not the lawmakers. Wrong. No, the king makes the law. Who is the most important? Not the advisors. That we see. What? No, not them. The runners. The runners who run the law out to the other kingdoms. Right? Elsewhere in Tanakh, we have kings who make laws. We have advisors. Right? But we do not have an obsession with the people who run the king's messages out to the provinces. Here, in Esther, we have an obsession with them. In fact, we use all these words that nobody knows what they mean, right? We have absolutely no idea. Yeah, all those words that nobody knows what they mean, not in Hebrew, not in English, right? The
I kind of guessed that it was just like the English word that they
use. Right, but we have this. Right, there's this obsession with these runners who send out law in the proper language for each country. Right, these sofrim and then the achshar panim and the pachot and all those people. Right, all these words we don't know exactly what they mean, but because law is so central to the way Persia runs. So everybody involved in that process, the people who write the law, who advise the law, who deliver the law, who write it in different languages, right? This is an obsession in Persia. Right? That's what keeps it together. Right? It's, by the way, it's important to understand the theological implications of there being an empire like this. This I probably mentioned to you before, but what phrase do we use about God that is a little bit of a weird phrase, but almost definitely emerges from the age of empires? How do we refer to God? Let me make this clear. In English, there's a phrase we use for God called Melech Malchei Amlachim. How do people translate it in English? Because it's wrong. King of Kings. That's absolutely wrong.
No, it's King of Kings over Kings.
It's King of Kings.
King of Kings.
Yeah. Yeah, what the heck does King of Kings mean?
No, it's not
right, no, it, in English it'd be translated as the King of Emperors.
Yeah.
Or the Emperor of Emperors. Right? Malchei Amlachim is an emperor, is a king over kings. So Melech Malchei Amlachim is the king over the emperors. Right? Because once you have Nebuchadnezzar, and once you have Ahasuerus, who aren't kings, they're emperors. So to highlight God's greatness, he can't be a king, and he can't be a king of kings. He has to be the king of kings, i.e. the king of emperors, right? Right. This phrase comes in vogue post this. Right. This was something right Clapper pointed out to me once. Right. That Melech Malchei Amlachim is not king of kings; it's king of emperors, right? And that makes sense when you're dealing with the beginning of the age of empires.
When you're dealing with kings who rule over other kings.
Correct. When you talk about kings who rule over kings, so then God is the king of kings. Right, or the king of emperors. Fine. So law is really important. We understand why this is a central theme. There's a problem, though. As we said, the role of law is to constrain human passion. What is the role of law in Esther?
Whatever the king wants.
Very good. In Esther, the role of law is not just the king. The role of law is to codify caprice. Yes, right. Let us pay attention to the laws in our book. First law in the book is, I want to read you this law, and then, again, the lullaby effect has set in, so you're not even surprised, but now let me read you this pasuk again, and you tell me if this makes any sense. Vashtia chadat einones. The drinking was according to the law. What was the law? There was no coercion. Because the king had established into law al kol rav beito, on everyone, that the law was la'asot kirson ish ve'ish, that people do whatever they want. The first time we are introduced to law in the Megillah is the law is you do whatever you want. Okay? In a sane society, that's where, what do? We don't set up a law. Right? If the law, I mean, sure, for sure. In a normal, sane society, if you invite someone to a party, you don't need a law on the book that says you cannot coerce them to drink. You just say, enjoy the food, enjoy the drink.
But that's where if you invited somebody to a party, and you gave them a certain amount of wine, they had to drink all of it, and they had to pay.
You can give whatever background you want to this. You can come up with whatever you want. The fact is that law...
counter law to go ahead and say...
Yeah, but you understand how it's weird. The first time we're introduced to law in the Megillah is a law which codifies that people do whatever they want, and you cannot, under no circumstances, shall you not let people do whatever they want. That is the law. Right, that is the law. First law we get. Second law. What's the second law?
Vashti.
Yes, Vashti. So now I want to analyze this here. Okay? The king is angry at his wife. He wants to punish her. This is a moment of anger, a moment of passion, a moment where he's out of control. Okay? In a normal society, what should the role of law be?
To
constrain that moment of passion. But here, not only do we say the law is the king can do whatever he wants, we have this wonderful, unbelievably subversive moment where what is the brilliant suggestion of Mimuchan? No, don't kill her.
No.
No, please. Please, please, please. Set a retroactive law, right? Set a retroactive law that what?
That men should be the keepers of the household.
Right? So he says, first of all, set a law that Vashti should be gotten rid of and the better person to take care of her, right? So he pretends that this is not a whim. It becomes law, right? And we create a retroactive law that...
He's trying to find precedent to kill her. So he's like, oh, the law system is super crazy around here. So nobody will
but you understand, right? The law isn't constraining him. What is the law doing? It's acting as a cover for his caprice. Right? He can do whatever he wants. As long as you pretend that it's all justified in the name of law. So suddenly you realize there's a pattern that is emerging here, right? There's a slight, that law is very important, which might make you think that, you know, Persia is very orderly and everything, everyone is under control and people are reasonable. Instead, law is a cover to do whatever you want. Or in fact, mandates that you do whatever you want, right? There's this very vina fochu, as it were, right, theme going on here, where law does the exact opposite of what it's supposed to do, right? It covers for people's caprice rather than actually reining them in. And then, in an unbelievable chutzpah, right, in an unbelievable moment, as we said, Haman decides that he's going to kill all the Jewish people. Now, why? We know. Why does he want to kill the Jewish people?
Because one person
annoyed him. Pasnished. You can't kill someone because he had a fight with you. Oh, I got a better idea. What am I going to do? Oh, I'm going to kill all the Jews. But why? Why? This is the unbelievable thing, right? He has a personal feud, But how is he going to hide the fact that he just, really just wants to kill Mordecai as a personal feud? What is it? What does he say? Kill all the Jews. Why?
Because they're bad
for the king. Because they don't follow the law. Because they don't. Yes. Listen to this. Yes. Because he says, "V'b'chol medina v'medina, makom asher dvar hamelech v'dato magia." Because wherever the law of the king reaches, right? Right, this is where it's going to happen. Sorry, I'm skipping already ahead, right? But the law goes wherever the law of the king goes. Why? What did he say? Because he says, Vayomer alamad l'melech ha-chashmeirosh, yesh no am echad mifuzar mifarad bein ha-amim b'chol medinot malchutecha, v'datehem shonot v'kolam v'dateh ha-melech einam osim. The problem is they don't keep your laws. They have different laws. Now, this is amazing, considering the laws we know. I mean, what does that mean? That they have constraints on how much people drink? I mean, what exactly does this mean? Right? Meaning, right, that's the... So far, we know of two laws that you that the king has, right? One is that you have to be allowed to drink whatever you want, right? And the other is that, right, the law is that the king can take revenge against his wife. So what exactly does this mean, that they have different laws? I mean, they actually have laws? They have norms? Right? Meaning, what does this mean? This is the chutzpah. And he uses this as a cover. So you have this this lawless people, which is his excuse for covering his own personal vendetta.
It's upsetting that we have moral laws as opposed to civil laws.
Yeah, I don't even know, right? You don't even... who knows what's going on? Right? Right? And of course, right, the gzera goes out to all the places where the law of the king is, of course, because these are the people who are against the law. So the decree will go wherever the law is. So you discover that there's this very bizarre thing going on in Persia, that law, on the one hand, is like the god, right? Everything, no one can ever go against the law. And again, right, obviously we see that at the end of the book, where she says, don't let them kill my people, and he says, nothing I can do, it's the law, right? Meaning, right, it's crazy. They worship the law to let them do totally horrible things, right? And then when they want to do horrible things, they make up a law, right? So there's a veneer of order, which is just hiding capriciousness, right? This is Persia in a nutshell, right? Everything is about law, but nothing is lawless, right? Everything is lawless. Nothing is ordered. Nothing is organized. There is no self-control. There's nothing, right? And in fact, if you want evidence of this, right before Haman says, I want to kill all the people who have different laws. How does he decide how he's going to kill them? With a go roll. He literally rolls a dice. Right? Meaning, this is, right, this person who's complaining that other people are disordered is taking a personal vendetta and highlighting that it's complete chaos by rolling the dice. Right? This is Persia in a nutshell. You look at Persia, it is a satire of a satire. I mean, it's insane. Right? There you go. But there's a problem. So if that's the case, if this is Persia, you would expect that the Jews would have a different theology, right? Would have a different vision of the world, right? Meaning, isn't that what the Megillah tells us? We are Dateim Shonot, right? So this is like the way Persia works. Then presumably the Jews act differently. Okay, good. So someone want to tell me, this is the Persian way that the world works. Someone want to tell me, what is the Jewish vision of how the world works, right? How have you always been told, what is the message of the Megillah? What do Jews believe?
Oh,
God runs the show. Great, that's what we've always been told. I was at, a few years ago, it was Shabbat Zachor, and I was in Petach Tikva for Shabbat, for my sister's Shabbat Sheva Bracha. Okay, it was right after my sister got married. And because it was Shabbat Zachar and whatever, people were giving Divrei Torah, and someone said this: what we learn from the Megillah are there are no coincidences in life, right? So then, different people, different families have different minhagim about how long you have Divrei Torah. So in my brother-in-law's family, they like a lot of Divrei Torah.
I mean, that's it.
What?
Isn't your brother-in-law also like a
member
of the system?
No, not that brother-in-law. That's Ora's sister's husband.
Okay.
No. My brother-in-law's family, they like a lot of Divrei Torah and long Divrei Torah. Like that's, their family likes long, right? Like they like their Seder to go till 3 a.m, right? That type of, right? My Seder ends at like 11 o'clock at night, right? Like I am, right? Like, my Seder, there's a mitzvah to teach my kids. My kids are tired. We move quickly. If we're going to say things, they're short. They're to the point. We move on, right? Like I don't do long, right? It's not my, so they asked me, do you want to give a Divrei Torah? And I was like, look, my personal belief is there should not be multiple Divrei Torah or not more than two at any meal. Like I just can't, right? Like I don't think people actually listen. Maybe it's because I'm a rabbi, and I know, I have seen how much people actually pay attention, right? So we don't. But all the speech, but I was in a quandary, because all the speeches were from his side, because they like giving multiple, but, so like, should I not represent my family, right? Or should I go against my principle, because I would have been Dvar Torah number 4 for the night, right? So I asked my sister, because it was her wedding, so whatever she said. And my sister said, here's the deal. I think mommy and daddy will like if we're represented. But I agree with you. I don't like. So you give a Dvar Torah in under 3 minutes. That was the compromise that we had. Okay? What? That should be the rule with all different. Okay. When I first moved to Toronto, after my second Shabbos, someone came over to me and he said, there are 4 types of Dvar Torah. The best Dvar Torah are short and good. The second best Dvar Torah is short and not good. The third best Dvar Torah is long and good, and the worst is long and bad. Right? This is after my drasha, and he said, your Dvar Torah was in the first 2. And then he walked away. he's a wonderful person. He has an interesting sense of humor. So fine. So what did I say? So what they had said was there had been a long Dvar Torah about this point, which is the message of the Megillah is there is no coincidence. So I got up and in 2 minutes and 42 seconds, my sister timed it. My sister is very funny, and my sister is my sister has a good sense of humor. I've probably mentioned my sister was in a stand-up troupe, right? My sister is like stand-up comedy. Like improv stand-up. Like my sister is, she's very funny, and you know, so my sister has a sense of humor, so she timed it. It was 2 minutes and 42 seconds, right? That was what I promised, under 3 minutes, and it was, right? So I said a shortened version, but I'll give you a little bit more than 2 minutes here on it. So Rav Forman says, okay, what is the most critical moment in the Megillah where someone comes and gives his vision of the world? Oh, come on. Mordechai in Perek Dalet, where he says to Esther,
even if you don't.
Very good. So now let's see. Everyone misremembers this, but now I want to actually analyze this with you. What does he say? Okay? So everyone thinks that the message of Mordechai's message is there is no coincidence, except he actually says the exact opposite. Because what does he say? So Rabbi Foreman has this very nice thing. Imagine that you are trying, I've said this to you before, but I will remind you again. Imagine you want to compel Esther to risk her life because she's violating the das, remember the law, that no one can go into the king unless he puts down his shavit hazav. So Esther comes and says, if I go, I'm going to be killed. So what's the proper thing to tell her? If you don't go, we're all going to die. What does Mordechai say? The exact opposite. which is, oh, you're afraid to die? No, you must go, because if you don't go, we will definitely be saved without you. Right? That is a very compelling speech, right? You're putting your life on the line for absolutely no reason, because it will definitely, definitely work out somehow. Somebody else. I have no idea how, but it'll work out. Yeah, that's what he says to her. He says, no, no, you should risk your life, because otherwise you will die, right? You will die, but we will be saved. How? I have no idea. I don't know. It'll happen somehow. Somehow, actually, it'll happen, right? That is like the least compelling speech that has ever happened.
No, it's right. Super compelling.
I'm, you're right.
I'm going to risk my life now, so I don't die later.
Yes, but why die later? Shit, he doesn't explain why. You will be lost. Lost. Why lost?
Yeah.
It's not death. You'll be lost. Why will you be lost? I don't know. You'll be lost because you'll be assimilated into this miserable life of being queen. It'll be terrible for you. You will be terrible. You will be the queen. You will be the empress of the world. You will have a miserable life and be lost in your anonymous castle. So, I mean, like, what exactly is going on? It's like, it's the weirdest speech ever, right? It's very weird. And if you think, you read that and you say, yes, the message is that there are no coincidences, right? No, it's actually the opposite. He says, don't worry, you don't want to do it. Okay, it'll happen. I don't know. Someone else will go. You should go because this is why you happen to become queen. But you don't do it. So someone else will, I don't know. It'll happen. It'll happen, right? Something will happen. It'll be some other coincidence will happen. It'll all work out. Right? Forman has the following thesis, which I really like. And he says, the difference between the Jewish theology and the Persian theology in the Megillah are different than what you thought. Everyone in the Megillah believes that there's a certain amount of order in the world and a certain amount of chaos. But the question is, how do those play out? In Persia, the truth, the deep truth about the world is that the world is chaotic and capricious, and you do whatever you want, and there's no order, and there's no rhyme or reason. So how do you control for it? By pretending that there's order. You pretend that everything is law, that everything is under the veneer of dot. But when you just scrape behind the dot, it's unrestrained chaos, right? And therefore, if you think about it, the laws are, people do whatever they want, right? The king pretends that his feud with his wife is an expression of a retroactive truth of how husbands and wives should interact, right? You pretend that the reason that you want to kill the Jews is because their law is different and therefore they are a threat to society, but really it's a personal vendetta, and you decided that they were going to be killed by throwing the dice, right? So the deep truth of the world is there is no order and there is chaos, right? But you mask that by pretending that everything is ordered and everything is legitimate and above board and thought out and law. The Jewish theology is exactly the opposite, which is the world has a telos, right? There is a end goal for the world. In the deepest truth, things will work out, right? The deepest truth of the world is there's an order, but who does what and which person makes choices and how they make them, that isn't planned, right? The deep truth of the world, there's an order, but that plays out in unpredictable ways. So Mordechai says to Esther, listen, the deep truth of the world is that God will save us. But the truth is, how that happens really doesn't matter. Sure, God set up a bunch of coincidences. You can choose to use the opportunities that have been given to you to partake of the order, to be God's pawn, and to further the telos of the world. If you don't want to, that's fine. It's not our loss. We'll be saved somehow. You'll be lost. Right? You'll be lost because you won't have partaken the furthering of the plan of the world, but you don't want to. So fine, something else will happen. I don't know what will happen. Who cares? Right? There's a deep belief that the world is aiming towards a certain telos, but how it happens is actually not planned. Right? It's not planned. It's accidental. It's subject to human choices, to human free will, and that makes the world chaotic. What? Yeah, but what I like about it, what he's saying is that it's not, is there coincidence in the world or not? Everyone agrees there is, right? The question is the relative role, right? In Persia, the deep belief about the world is that it's chaos, and therefore people can do whatever they want. The only role to law and order is as a veneer, to make us pretend that what we're doing fits into a vision, a greater picture of what the world should do, so that I don't have to admit that I'm just being petty. Law is an excuse. Order is a mirage. But the Jewish vision, as Mordechai, is the exact opposite. No. The deep truth about the world is that there is a telos. There is a goal. The world is aiming at something. But things aren't planned. You have free will. You can do what you want, right? But it's not planned. You're not doing this because there are coincidences, right? There are accidents. This could happen however it wants. But you don't use the order of the world, the truth that there's an order, doesn't let you hide behind it. In fact, it's machayev you. Because what it says is, God has a plan for the world. Either you choose to be part of it or not. God doesn't need you, right? You need to choose to tap into the telos of the world. Because God has many pawns. He could use whatever he wants. You don't want it, he'll do something else. It's an accident, right? Because of free will, it's basically accidental, right? But if human beings take responsibility and choose to be the pawn that happens to push the tellers of the world forward, that's not, it doesn't help God, it helps you. So in Persia, right, law, order, telos, the goals of the world, there are none, right? There's just capriciousness, you do whatever you want. But you pretend that it's this highfalutin expression of goodness because it's the law. Right? You pay lip service to law and order. But your deep belief about the world is that everyone does whatever they want. Everyone acts on their own whatever. And the Jewish vision is the opposite, which is no. Broadly speaking, there's a plan for the world. Right? Your job is to tap into that telos of the world and take advantage of the accidents, right? Is to say, by chance, I happen to be in the opportunity, right, in this situation where I have the opportunity to further the goodness in the world, to further the telos of the world. That may be an accident, but I nullify what's good for myself to tap in to the deep order that pervades the world. Right? Those are two completely different visions. Right? They both believe that there's a certain sense of chance. But the question is, do you use a veneer of chance, right, to justify your own whims? Right? Or does the belief that there's a deep order in the world force you to take advantage of the chances and the opportunities that you just happen to get? Right? So it's not just different, it's inverse. right? And then Mordecai's speech makes a lot of sense, right? It's, listen, Esther. There is a plan to the world. But I don't know how it's supposed to get there. That's complete. You roll the dice on how you're going to save us. If you happen to be given the opportunity by chance to save us, right? He doesn't even say, let's think about what he says to her. He doesn't even say, this is, right? People misremember it. He doesn't say, this is why you became queen. What does he say?
Who knows?
Maybe this is why you became queen. Right? Meaning he says, look, all I know is that there's a plan to the world. I don't even know if this is why you became queen, but it might be. Right? It might be. It's possible that this fluke wasn't a fluke. Maybe it's not. Maybe it was an accident. Right? Esther, listen, I don't know. I don't know if this is God's plan, and I don't know if it's an accident. All I know is that right now, because of how the chips fell, you have the opportunity to further the ultimate goal of the world. Do you take advantage of chance to redeem yourself or not? You don't want to? Don't. You don't want to? Don't. I don't care. Do whatever you want. Right? It's not our loss. It's yours. Right? It's are you going to say, you're going to put yourself first and say, this was just a coincidence and I don't have, right? I can do whatever I want. You want to be a good Persian, right? Do whatever you want. Go ahead. You want to further the ultimate goals of the world, even though you don't have to, and someone else will do it? Fine. But this is the difference, is that everyone agrees there's a degree of chance, and there's a degree of order, and goals, and, right, telos. But the question is, right, is the real rule that you see guiding the world chance? And therefore, law is just the way you protect yourself from criticism by saying, I'm just keeping the rules? Or do you say, no. I'm a minimalist. I believe the world has a goal. That's about the extent to which I believe in order. Right? God has a plan. But because I believe in free will, things are messy. And there are coincidences. Right? There are chances. Right? The challenge in life is to take advantage of complete chance to be selfless rather than selfish. Right? And that's the theology that Mordecai says to Esther, which is it will work out. There's a deep order in this world. But I don't know. I'll be honest. I don't know if this is why you're here. I have no idea. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe there's no hashkacha in how you got here. Maybe. Maybe you're just queen because you were beautiful. Maybe. I don't know. Right? What I'm telling you is that there's order to the world, and you have an opportunity to use the hand that you've been dealt to become selfless, to tap into the vision for the world. You want to? Great. You don't want to? Also fine. Right? So it's a question of it's about responsibility. It's do you believe in an ultimate chaos and therefore people don't have responsibility because nothing really matters and all you need is to cover yourself and make yourself look respectable? Right? That's the vision of Persia. You can always hide behind the law, right? That's what Ahasuerus says, I'll let the Jews get killed because, the law's there. What can I do, right? On a bureaucratic technicality, I'll let genocide happen, but it's not my fault. That's the law, right? Or do you say the opposite, which is what Esther does, which is, listen, the world will do what it wants. My job in life is to take care of opportunities and be as selfless as possible, even though I don't need to. But the best thing you can do is to tap in to the ultimate vision for the world, even if it's going to work out. Even if it's chaos, even if because God knows that the world has free will and therefore has chance, he'll figure it out whether he need, whether you do it or not. But the question is, you take advantage of it. Right? Those are two radically different visions. Okay? Like I said, I happen to think that as good as his book is, the series he gives on this, I think is even better. Right? Okay, fine. We'll end there.